This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our broadcast in online Main Street across North Dakota. And today we're going to start our show with a story that's been in the state now for well over a century, probably going on to 130 years or so. And that is the story of Forum Communications Company. We're going to talk about a new book that's out by the former Forum editorial page editor and a friend of Prairie Public and a frequent guest on Main Street, as a matter of fact, Jack Zaleski. Jack, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Doug. It's always good to be with you.
The book is brand new, Forum Communications Company, A Narrative History, 1980 to 2018. So were you commissioned to write the book, Jack?
Yes. I retired from my formal job at the Forum as the editorial page editor in 2017 after 30 years or so in the job. During some of the later years of that time, the publisher at the time, Bill Marcil Sr., who is now the chairman of the board of the company, had always been talking about writing a new history of the Forum, an updated history. One was written in 1978 by Melvin Moline, someone I think you knew, Doug.
Yes.
And that came out in 78, and it was a academic history, very academic history, full of great information, really a good resource for me as I started on the new book. But Bill Marcil and his wife Jane and Bill Jr. wanted not an academic history. They wanted someone to tell the story in narrative form. Therefore, I call it a narrative history. I don't pretend to be an historian. It's not an academic history by any means. It's a narrative story of the Forum from the beginning, but mostly concentrating on the years from about 1970 to now. And so they commissioned me to do it. I worked on it for a couple of years. It was ready to go in the spring, published and done, and the volumes all prepared. I had boxes of them stacked in my office, and we were ready to do a rollout in the spring. But as we all know, the pandemic cranked up, everything shut down, and so we put a hold on everything. But then we decided late this fall that we couldn't wait any longer to do it, so we rolled the book out. We started doing promotions. We had a virtual meeting, a virtual community meeting that was attended by, 80 or something people online to discuss the book. It was really a good session. There were people from not just North Dakota, but other people who have connections to this area and to the company. And that went very well. And so now we're advertising the book. We're promoting it. I'm going to get it in the bookstores in a few days. Frankly, sales are going pretty well.
Well, you and I have crossed paths several times over the course of 40-plus years. I know that you originally were the editor of the Devil's Lake Journal. What brought you to the Forum?
Yeah, I came to the state in about 1969. I'd been here before for a little bit. Settled up in Devil's Lake because I'd met a girl. she had finished work at UND, finished her studies at UND and was working at the North Dakota School for the Deaf. So when I drove out here in my 65 Volkswagen Beetle, the only reason I stopped in Devil's Lake was because she was there. She had made arrangements for me to interview at the Devil's Lake Journal, which at that time was a family-owned paper owned by the Graham family. And I interviewed with the publisher there, and I had sent him some of my material early. So he had it, and I walked in, and he introduced himself, and we talked for a while, and he said, "Well, when do you want to start?" And I said, "Anytime." He said, "Start tomorrow." And so that was in 69. So we stayed up there for about 20 years and ran a really good small daily newspaper. I was the general manager and editor when I left there. In the meanwhile, people like the late Joe Dill, who was editor of the Forum, and the late Terry Devine, who was the managing editor at the Forum, and publisher Marcil had been asking me if I would be interested in coming down to the Forum. And at the time I wasn't, but eventually the situation changed so that Sandy, my wife, wanted to do her master's work, and there was a good program here at in North Dakota State University for her. the offer that Bill Sr. made to me to be editorial page editor of this newspaper was really, really hard to turn down. I'd always called it the best newspaper job in the state. So in 1987, we made the move, and we have been here ever since. And it was a good move. It was a good move.
Well, I was raised in a family newspaper. The Becker County Record started publishing, I think, in the late 1870s. My great-grandfather ran the paper. My dad co-ran it with a partner for many years. It was absorbed by Forum Publishing a long time ago and has since gone out of print. But there aren't many family-owned newspapers really left. They used to be everywhere. How do you think the Black and Marseille family, and this is Norman Black and Bill Marseille Sr., how do you think that ownership shaped the company?
Oh, that's been everything. That's been everything, Doug. You know, I noticed, just as a way of comparison, when I came to Devil's Lake, it was third-generation ownership. With the Graham family. Then they sold it to a company that had been buying up small newspapers. For one reason or another, the family didn't want to stay with it. They sold it. And that the difference was profound. I mean, the difference in local ownership and the commitment to the community compared to that out-of-state ownership, it was headquartered in Ithaca, New York, I think, was not a good thing. And so the difference in what you could do, how much money went back into the paper, the commitment of the paper to the community itself was different. And so coming down here to Fargo and beginning to understand the history and heritage and tradition of this newspaper going all the way back to, frankly, to 1878. And then when the Black family, the first Black, bought the paper in April of 1917, and it's been in family ownership, the Black and Marseille family ownership, since then. That is a remarkable, remarkable accomplishment. That's what, five generations. And so when you look at the newspaper landscape around the country and realize that fewer and fewer of these family-owned newspapers and family-owned media groups, the Forum, of course, Forum Communications has more than the Forum, but those family-owned organizations, media organizations and newspaper organizations are disappearing for all sorts of reasons. A lot of it is, a younger generation isn't interested. The media economy has changed so much because of technology and also because of the virus, that it's very, very difficult to keep an organization healthy, economically healthy. The Forum has been, Forum Communications has been managed well from the beginning, from the first Black to the next two, and then to Bill, a senior, and now to Bill Jr., has been very agile and very adaptive responding to the changes in the industry and in the media economy, and continues to be successful. And that's reflected in the book.
Jack Zaleski is the author of Forum Communications Company, A Narrative History, 1980-2018. And I remember this larger-than-life personality, John Paulson. He used to enter the room before he actually entered the room. I did not really know the detail that is covered in the book about the attempted coup by former editor John Paulson and other shareholders back in 1984. That was an interesting story. That could be a teledrama.
You know, when I knew about it, because when I first started at the paper, it was still fresh in the minds of people like Joe Dill and Terry Devine, because Joe had come to the paper in about 1981 and replaced John D. Paulson as editor. And John D. Paulson did not really want to be replaced, but he was. And so within 3 years or so, he was leading this attempted hostile takeover, this attempted coup, with some shareholders and family members, Black family members, who were very intimately tied to the Forum and had been for many years. And so when I dug into that, I found the headlines, and the headlines of the time were straight stuff, a Forum involved in shareholder dispute, blah, blah, blah. But when I dug into it and sat down and talked with some of the people who were directly involved with it, including Bill Sr. and his wife Jane, including Pat Weir, who was from the Vogel Law Firm, who was the company's attorney at the time, and others who were involved with that attempt. Lloyd Case, who was a chief executive here and retired in about 1980. He came here in 1982, retired just about the same time I did. And those people were key in waging that battle with those shareholders. And what I found as I dug into it is that it was far more than just a dry business story. I mean, there were, as you said, Doug, there were these larger-than-life personalities involved, like JDP, John D. Paulson, and some of the people he had with him. And it became, as Bill Marcil described it, used this quote in the book, he says, it got nasty. And so I tried to reflect that in chapter one of the book. I opened the book, after the introduction and all that stuff, with that. Chapter one is that story. And it's a very personal story. It's a family story. It's a business story. There's a lot of intrigue in it. It's a legal story. It has all these elements of like a made-for-TV drama, as you said. And I think a lot of people, even those people who were here during that period and who knew that something was going on, didn't realize how much was going on and what was at stake. And we make the case when we talk about this now that had the Paulson cabal won, you know, had they won that fight, you and I wouldn't be talking here today. None of us who were involved with the forum since then would be here, would have been involved. The paper likely would have been sold to one of the large chains, and it would have changed everything. But Bill and Jane decided early on that the tradition and heritage and the family ownership of the paper and the local, rooted locally here in Fargo-Moorhead, was extremely important. And so they pulled out all the stops and found a way to buy out those shareholders who were with Paulson, and they did. And the ultimate agreement paid them off and forever severed them from any role in forum communications, and that's the way it's been ever since.
You worked with several news editors over the years. You were the opinion page or the editorial page editor. Who was your favorite?
Oh, gosh. I would have to say Joe Dill.
Yeah.
Joe was the real thing. He came to the forum already as a mature, experienced newsman. He had been with the Associated Press for many years and had worked in many places in Charlotte, Baltimore, Chicago. And then became the bureau chief for Minneapolis, St. Paul, where he was in charge of the AP units in three states, Minnesota, North Dakota, and South Dakota. And so I'd known him before I came to the forum because at the Devil's Lake paper, we'd go to the AP meetings once a year, and Joe, of course, was there. And so I got to know him personally also, but I also got to know him as the consummate professional. And people who knew him when he became editor at the forum knew that he really loved the place. He was looking for, as I say in the section, the editors, when I talk about Joe, that he was looking for a place where he could settle his young family at the time and quit moving around with the AP, because he would have been moved again and again and worked his way up the AP ladder and probably ended up in New York running the show. He was that good. But he wanted a solid, locally based, locally rooted, locally owned newspaper. Bill Marcil Sr. knew him through the AP, and when John Paulson left and was eased out, Bill offered the job to Joe, and it was one of the best hires that Bill Sr. ever made. And Joe was editor about 17 years. He died on the job, just short of retirement. But one of the reasons I did come here, and one of the reasons it was an easy move for me, was Joe. And working with him was a pleasure every day because he was not only a good journalist, an excellent journalist, he was also a good manager, a good people person, and he understood this newspaper's role in the community. And he himself became very visible in the community as kind of a representative of the newspaper. In fact, the night he died, he was on his way to an event that the Forum sponsored during those years where they honored student athletes, high school student athletes. It was one of his favorite events. And he was all dressed up and ready to go to that event. He was always the host and the speaker and didn't make it, of course, that time. But so I have to say that of all the editors I worked with, I had the most respect and admiration and awe sometime of Joe Dill.
Well, he was a splendid fellow. I remember him, too. And I think Matt Von Panon is a pretty strong editor right now as well.
Matt is doing it. Matt is the thing about Matt that is so perfect for the paper right now. And we say some of this in that section on the editors, Matt's section in there, is that Matt was made editor just at the right time, just as these changes in technology were coming. Matt was young enough to know how to adapt the entire newsroom to these changes, but steeped in traditional journalism. He went to school at Morehead State and was an outstanding student. And steeped in that traditional journalism, the standards and values of good journalism, that he wasn't intimidated by the technology and hasn't let the news operation lose those standards for quality and all the things that we learned as young journalists. And so he was the right choice at the right time. And now he's into his 14th year, I think, as editor, and he's doing a great job.
You know, I started in broadcasting in 1975 and worked in town here for a couple of competitors with WDAY-TV and radio. And at that time, we looked at the dominance of the newspaper, TV, and radio holdings as sort of a conglomerate that was almost impenetrable in terms of competitiveness. That is an important arm of the enterprise now. Now, broadcasting and newspapers are moving. They're transitioning now, perhaps ultimately online. But that has been an important part of the enterprise, too, the broadcasting piece.
Yeah, Bill wanted a chapter on the broadcast division of the company. And so chapter, I forget which one it is, the number, but is about WDAY and WDAZ. There's an interesting history there, which I'm sure you're aware of, Doug, as in broadcast. DAY radio will be 100 years old in 2022. It was the pioneer radio station in the state, the first one to go on the air.
It's got a W.
Yes, it's got a W, and I explain what the W is about in the book also, because some people wonder, should it be a K? No, it's a W. But anyway, that history is fascinating. Then in the early 50s, when television came on board, DAY became the second television station to go on the air in North Dakota. Minot was the first. And so there's a fascinating story there. And, you know, you remember, you've been around long enough to remember those personalities that came through radio and TV that made them so strong. They were local personalities that were devised, you know. And then, of course, you had people come along like Peggy Lee, who got her start in Fargo and on the radio and DAY radio and television, and personalities like Dewey Berquist, the weatherman, and on and on. So there's a great history of broadcasting, and television remains, DAY television remains very strong. So it's going to be interesting to see how broadcast develops or adapts to the changes in technology. But what the Forum Communications has done is meld the website into one site that includes broadcast and print, and that's worked pretty well. The website's very strong; it's doing quite well. And then now with the changes in publication in the print product, with only a paper print product being published on Wednesdays and Saturdays, that's made a big change also. But the e-paper online, I find myself, being an old paper guy, liking the e-paper online. It's a very easily accessed product. It's a very reader-friendly kind of thing. And it's larger than it normally would be in print, because you have the option of just adding electronic pages again and again. So the changes are difficult for some, especially people who like to have that paper newspaper on in front of their with their coffee in the morning. But the e-paper is catching on. More and more and more subscribers are catching on much faster, I think, than was anticipated. So that's a good thing.
Well, we both have a lot of experience just smelling the air in a newsroom because the printing plant has a certain scent that is almost perfume-like to some people, me included. But let's talk about the media environment we're in now. Mainstream media has become almost a pejorative term. The sanctity of the news pages and the purpose of the opinion section, the status is almost flipped in a sense. We've got the notion of alternative facts, the complicity of some information sources to spread misinformation, even disinformation now. That makes an enterprise like Forum Communications even more vital.
That's exactly right, Doug. And one of the things, you know, with all the changes, and, you know, there have been changes in the number of people working in the forum building, as the certain departments have lost people because their functions have gone away. But what I've seen, I still maintain an office in the forum building and come to the office mostly every day to work on various projects for the company. But what I have seen is that despite all the contraction that we've seen in some departments of the newspaper, there has been no such erosion of the number of people in the newsroom. The news function, if anything, has been bucked up even. There are more people working in gathering content, gathering news, writing news than before. So it's good to see that management knows that, the cliche is content is king. It really is. How it's distributed, of course, has changed. But if the content is there, it's reliable, it's credible, it's done by professional journalists who know what they're doing, who have the high standards of reporting, that's valuable. And that's what the ethic is in the forum's newsroom. And so the company has added to those resources rather than cut back, as some newspapers have, on their reporting staff. The forum has added to its reporting and editing staff. And the result is a news report that I look at every morning is really pretty good. And I think because of what you described is going on in the media landscape, it is vitally important for local and regional newspapers like the Forum and like some of the other newspapers Forum Communications owns, Rochester, Duluth, Grand Forks, Dickinson, and others, to maintain those high standards and to put into their newsrooms the resources to continue to cover their regions in their cities, and, you know, everything from local sports to local government, and also have in their various platforms for distributing the news credible, honest, factual, national, and international reporting. And the forum does that with the additional pages it's added for a national and international report. And you see that in the e-paper. The idea of the mainstream media, and you're right, it's used in a pejorative way. But the fact of the matter is, when you break the mainstream media up into its various components, the local and regional newspaper or the local and regional broadcast news are very important to maintaining good news, not the junk that you see on cable or on online platforms and all the social media and things like that are really distortions of the news. They're not reports. So, the forum is not alone in this, but the forum is a leader in keeping those standards high and keeping the resources at work to gather that news and get it out there for people.
Jack Zaleski is the author of Forum Communications Company, A Narrative History, 1980 to 2018. The book is going to be going on sale, and sale profits will go to student scholarships, so that's a wonderful end as well. Jack, it's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Nice to talk with you, Doug. Thank you for the time.
Now the news with Danielle.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. A new online North Dakota United sponsor survey of 756 K-12 member teachers shows a noticeable increase of concern about COVID in the classroom and in the community since the last survey done in September. The same questions were asked, and NDU President Nick Archuleta says among the key findings of late October survey are some interesting emerging trends.
Do they want face masks in their schools? 86% of our members want face masks mandated in their schools, and 80% of our members want masks mandated in their communities. And these results come in. They transcend political party lines, Republicans and Democrats, for example, on the issue of mandating masks in the communities. 78% of Republicans wanted that done.
The new data showed many believe state leaders have not gone far enough to combat COVID, including a majority of members who identify as Republicans and independents from every part of the state. The survey also found 37% of K-12 teachers surveyed are still considering leaving their jobs. The Public Service Commission has issued a show cause order to CenturyLink as to why a customer in rural Amadon has been having phone service problems. Sharon and Gordon Gerbig complained to the PSC that they were having problems with quality of service. That complaint was lodged in August. Commissioner Randy Christman says as of the end of October, the issue had not been resolved.
The Gerbigs continue to have issues with quality of service to the point where service is at times non-existent and causes the Gerbigs to have concerns with safety, as well as the ability to conduct business and communicate with family members.
Christman says the August incident was not the first. He says the issues have drug on so much longer than that.
I find it unacceptable. Not everyone has cell service. Not everyone has options where they can go somewhere else for phone service.
The company has been ordered to show cause why it shouldn't face penalties or ordered to make corrections to the service. That hearing is scheduled for December 10th. And the Great Plains Food Bank has opened its new regional service center in Bismarck.
Our new regional service center will allow us to expand and enhance our programs and operations in central and western North Dakota. A more centrally located warehouse will improve our efficiencies as we bring donated food in and transport food out to our partner agencies and through our direct service programs.
Great Plains President Melissa Soblick says the new center is expected to support the distribution of 1.5 million pounds of surplus food in its first year of operation, which translates to 1.25 million meals. It will serve a network of 87 food pantries, shelters, and soup kitchens in central and western North Dakota. Soblick says last year Great Plains served 102,000 North Dakotans. She says this year, because of COVID-19, the food bank is now serving 135 North Dakotans. She says the COVID situation also meant some challenges for the organization.
The food donations that we rely on so greatly really plummeted right away. People were panic buying and retailers didn't have it to donate. And one of the things that we've resorted to doing is purchasing most of our food right now. So we're buying it by the truckload right off the market, bringing it in because we are committing to making sure that our shelves are stocked so all of the food pantries get the food that they need, even though we're not getting the donations that we typically get.
Great Plains now has two distribution centers, one in Fargo and one in Bismarck. The food bank serves all of North Dakota as well as Clay County, Minnesota. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Coming up this week on the Thomas Jefferson Hour, we have a very special broadcast, a Zoom conversation with Thomas Jefferson Hour listeners.
We wanted to know what just happened in the 2020 election, so we invited Jefferson Hour listeners from around the country and around the world to join us for a two-hour discussion of the process of the 2020 election and its still uncertain results.
We had comments from supporters of Trump and supporters of Biden, and we had calls from England, from Mexico, from Chile.
It was an amazing moment of civility. Nobody was offended. Nobody said outrageous things, but we had a wide range of responses to the election of 2020 and a very interesting discussion of what happens next in this, our happy republic.
Join us for all that and more on this week's Thomas Jefferson Hour.
Sunday at 11 Central, 10 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Poetry from Studio 47 comes to us from Patrick Hicks, writer-in-residence and a member of the English faculty at Augustana University in Sioux Falls. Today, he shares some favorite poems written by his students.
Regular listeners know that I usually focus on one poet. I give a little background on that poet's life. I offer a few points of interest about what makes the poem we're about to hear intriguing or thought-provoking or entertaining. Today, I'm going to do something a little bit different. I'm going to share a few poems with you that you'd almost certainly never run across. Let me explain. I have the very good fortune of teaching creative writing to whip-smart college students. I'm often very impressed with the caliber of work that's created in our classrooms at Augustana University. In fact, each year, I run across a number of poems that just knock my socks off. I thought I'd share three of these poems with you today. They all came across my field of vision in the last 12 months, and I think they deserve a larger audience than just our tiny classroom. The first poem is Dad by Jessica Ruff. I'm always a sucker for poems that are full of raw honesty and emotional bravery. For me, this is the good stuff. If I sense that a poet is being honest on the page, they will probably tell me something about the human condition. This particular poem offers up a childhood memory, and it's a memory that continues to burn into the present moment. I don't know how many times I've read it, and it gets me every time. Jessica is from Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and she recently graduated with a degree in English. This is Dad by Jessica Ruff. Growing up, there was a man who arrived on motorcycle, pink Barbie helmet in hand, leather coat, cigarettes, a poke in the side, Jess Jess. Was it my fault I couldn't say it? Dad, always a cold stone, clumsy on my tongue. Even years later, when the police dragged him away, his whiskey breath shouting in the halls of my high school, crying, "I love you, I love you," I never said it. And now, alone among the sharp cacti, there is a man underneath the sweltering sun, swigging another cold one, staring across the desert, hollowed and haunted, with only a smoky memory of his daughter, a silent ghost, Jess Jess, wafting upwards from his cigarette. Our next poem for today is Susanna and the Elders by Erica Dorsett. Erica is a junior, majoring in English. This poem won the Herbert Krauss Award for Poetry, and it was originally published in Augustana University's literary annual, Venture. It's always interesting to read a familiar story told from an unfamiliar perspective, and in this poem, the narrator views a story from the Old Testament from a woman's perspective. In many ways, this is a perfect poem for the Me Too movement. There is a long epigram to this poem, which I'll read now. It's absolutely crucial to hear this if we are to understand what is about to come. Here it is. Susanna and the Elders is an Old Testament story in which two lascivious older men accost a young wife, Susanna, who they found bathing in her garden, and attempt to coerce her into having sex with them. This, then, is Susanna and the Elders by Erica Dorsett. Older men look at young women like summer produce, eyeing honeydew flesh and berry-stained mouth, eyeing every orifice as a mouse does a hole in the floor. Older men talk to young women like they're tying a cherry stem with their teeth, red syrupy tongue darting out, serpentine, to taste her scent on the air, perfume, sweat, hair. Older men touch young women like they're boys again, dipping their fingers in honey, peeling oranges, puncturing grapes, curling their fists around peach pits, always crawling inside, inside, as if they've forgotten what warmth feels like, as if they never had mothers. Our last poem for today is the wonderfully titled To the Ex Who Told Me I Never Wanted to Date You in the First Place by Cameron Hay. It's no secret that humor is a great way to deal with pain, especially emotional pain. If you've had your heart broken, and really, who hasn't, there is power in writing how you feel. In this poem, Cameron Hay writes about all the bad things she'd like to see happen to her ex-boyfriend. It's a cathartic poem, and full of witty humor, too. Cameron is from Maple Grove, Minnesota. She is a junior at Augustana University, majoring in English. This is To the Ex Who Told Me I Never Wanted to Date You in the First Place by Cameron Hay. For him, I don't hope for misery or an STD. I don't hope for Alzheimer's, car accidents, or jail. However, for him, I do hope for photographs that never capture his good side. I hope for late buses, cold macaroni, shirts that are always a tinge too tight, and a radiator with a rattling screw. I hope for taco shells that fall apart with the first bite, and keys that disappear when he's late for work on a Monday morning. I hope for him a lifetime of Monday mornings. I hope for many first dates, but not so many second ones. I hope for the friend zone, for his brother to be better at everything, and a B+ in every class he'll take. I hope for him a long-term relationship that breaks right around the time his buddies get hitched.
Patrick Hicks, reading the poetry of students Jessica Ruff, Erica Dorsett, and Cameron Hay. Poetry from Studio 47 is recorded at Augustana University and is produced by Peter Folliard. Main Street Eats is next.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, investing in great ideas and the people who power them, in Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota, and the 23 Native nations that share that same geography. Learn more at bushfoundation.org.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton with Ashley Thornburg, and it's time for Main Street Eats.
Sue Balcom joins us once a week from her farm outside of Mandan, the Root Cellars Farm. Sue, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
It's soup season, am I right?
Oh my gosh, is it ever? After that beautiful, oh my gosh, there were a couple of glorious days this fall, and then all of a sudden it took a dive, and I'm thinking, well, I can always dig out my pressure cooker and start making soup, which, you know, more people are cooking at home, and it's so easy to clean out your refrigerator and make soup.
As my friend Lana says, everything soups.
That's right. Well, you remember that stone soup story
when you
were a kid where the community was starving, and then all of a sudden this person put on a pot of boiling water and threw a rock in there. And pretty soon somebody's like, hey, I got a little piece of celery. And, oh, I got a couple potatoes. And, yeah, there's a few carrots here. And pretty soon they had a wonderful community meal. So that's my thing today, is go out and have a community soup supper. Oh, wait, I forgot. We can't. We have to do it long distance. Never mind.
It makes me think that there was a time when soup was probably a practical way to make things go a little farther.
Hey, when I was growing up, I started working at the Gackle Cafe for LaVon Deitcher. And my mother was an excellent cook, but LaVon was a magician in the kitchen with leftovers. Take, for instance, you have leftover baked potatoes. You could add those to soup. Or if you had leftover roast beef, you could start a soup stock that way. A lot of people nowadays are like big into bone broth. And I have to laugh about that all the time because it's simply soup stock, you know, like bones or not, that's what you need to make soup stock. So I collect things, you know, as I go along, like when we're done eating chicken, I save the carcass, what I trim off of beef, I save that separately because you have beef broth and you have chicken broth, save turkey parts, ends of celery, ends of broccoli, you can save all that stuff. And if you have an Instant Pot, it takes like 20 minutes to make a pretty decent stock. And from that, of course, you can do many, many different things. And if you don't want to do that, they do have soup stock, beef stock, chicken stock, vegetable stock, if you're vegan, at the grocery store. So a couple of my favorite soups in the wintertime are tomato, carrot, potato, noodle. And then I make this vegetable soup that my mom used to make all the time when we were kids. And they're most four-ingredient soups.
Well, I remember, of course, the good advertising campaign for a certain kind of soup that is everywhere and makes about a gazillion varieties. Mm-hmm. But if you turn the can around and look at the contents, it's about a third sodium, salt. So there are healthier ways to make soup.
Right. And, you know, those soups have changed over the years. There was a time when I was in college, maybe even after that, when I used to eat one of those soups regularly. And now it is like cow snot. I mean, I'm sorry, but it's so gross.
You're not trying to get a marketing job there, I see.
No. Never. Although I must say I do use them for supplementary gravy and things like that now and then. So, but that's for another show. So, okay. One of the favorites that my family, when I asked my family what they wanted for Christmas dinner last year, my kids are like, we want grilled cheese sandwiches and your homemade tomato soup. And I'm just like amazed because it is so simple. You just simply take a half a stick of butter and throw in an onion that's been chopped up real fine and let that kind of get soft. Then you put a can of homemade tomatoes in. And if you don't have some, you can certainly use the ones that you have from the store and simmer that for a little bit. Meanwhile, you heat up a cup or so of milk. It depends on whether you like it really creamy or not. Then you use your stick blender and you put a tiny little bit of baking soda in the tomatoes to decrease the acidity. Because when you introduce the warm milk, it will curdle if you don't do that. So that's a very important step. But then you use your stick blender and you blend that all up till it's nice and creamy and season it with a little salt and pepper and make some really good fat grilled cheese sandwiches. And you have like a wonderful supper that took you maybe 20 minutes to do.
Well, when I was a kid, we had the tomato soup out of the can, but my mother made an incredible beef soup, vegetable beef soup. It was really, really good.
Well, and you know, it's a little difficult to get beef bones nowadays, too, from supermarkets because people, maybe now it's easier, but a couple years back, you know, it was like, why would anybody want your soup bones? But since we have a cow butchered at a meat market, I get everybody's bones. And so if you're going to use beef bones and beef trimmings and stuff, even chicken bones, chicken pieces, parts, turkeys, the best thing to do is to put the beef bones in the oven with some onion and maybe some old vegetables that you probably wouldn't eat. You know, I never throw anything away. And roast them. That roasting really deepens the flavor of your soup stock. After that, of course, is when you can put them in the pressure cooker, or you can just use a stock pot, like a big, huge pot, so it doesn't boil over. And you don't want to boil it. You don't want to boil those bones and vegetables. You want to simmer them just right under boiling. And my mother always, no matter what it was, ham parts or turkey parts, she would put in a couple of bay leaves and three allspice balls, in addition to her salt and pepper. And so I do that now also. And I don't know if it makes a difference, but I never make soup without those ingredients in them.
That sounds delicious. I just have a quick freezing question for vegetables, because I make a fair amount of veggie stock because I eat a lot of veggies. And so I just, you know, throw those ends.
Don't want to throw it away, right?
Exactly, yes. Yeah. And I used to double bag them in Ziploc bags. And then I was at the point I was making stock often enough that I was just getting annoyed. So I started tossing them just in a bucket with a loose lid in the freezer. Am I going to regret that? Do I need to go back to the bag
no.
system?
I'm going to do that.
Oh, okay.
That's an excellent idea.
Just basically as long as they don't start to crystallize, as long as I'm making stock often enough.
Right. And, okay. You know, think about it. You're basically putting them in there when they're past their prime anyway.
Wow.
And so that, as long as they're not in there and got really frostbit, you know, we make soup often, like maybe once a month or a month and a half apart. There's not much you can do to that stuff that's already been done to it. My mom used to, when she'd make soup, she would simmer her vegetables and her chicken in the same pot. And when I left the house, she came to my house once for dinner and she's like, how do your vegetables stay so crisp? Here's the secret. You do not use the same vegetables in your vegetable soup as you do for your soup stock. So what you want to do is after you make your stock, you want to get rid of everything in there and then let it set. Now, the beauty of North Dakota is you can put that pot outside and the fat will coagulate a lot sooner than if it's summertime. So the fat will rise to the top. Now, leave that on there if you're going to store that soup stock in the refrigerator. But when you're ready to use your stock, then you want to pull that fat off of there and you have virtually fat-free stock. and it still has all the flavor. So then you want to do the, what's the French thing with the carrots and the onions and the celery? Mirepoix?
Mirepoix.
Yes.
There you go. I got the German accent on that, which, by the way, people, I heard somebody or saw a comment that was made on my Facebook page or something, and they're like, you have the perfect Plains woman accent. I'm like, what is that? It's obviously not French. So anyway, so you do the French, do the French thing, and then you can add whatever you want to make a really wonderful vegetable soup. You can add roasted sirloin steak or round steak. You can brown hamburger first before you do the onions, carrots, and celery, and then you have kind of a beefy vegetable soup. My mom used to add Mexican spices, and then it was a Mexican vegetable soup. Of course, she used a lot of canned vegetables, but you know, if you can your own or freeze your own corn, beans, peas, add some kidney beans for protein. You know, there's a bazillion things that you can put together in a vegetable beef stock that is, it's just wonderful and warm. And then you serve it with some fabulous bread, homemade bread, which everybody's on board making their own bread these days. And you have really a good meal. But if you're like I am, you're going to end up eating it for 2 weeks. Because yeah. There's something about that big cauldron of boiling soup
that
stock.
You have
like,
to fill.
If I add one more thing, just one more thing. Now, if you're not a fan of all those vegetables, you've really got to try potato soup or carrot or squash. Those are creamy soups that are basically the same. You just brown your vegetables, your potatoes, your squash or your carrots in lots of butter with onions. And then you add your chicken stock and simmer that till those vegetables are soft. And then you can either puree it or you can leave it chunky. Some people have this thing about eating pureed soups that are that thick. You can season them up with whatever you want. Squash and carrot soups are great with nutmeg and coriander, cinnamon, those kinds of spices, a little bit of sour cream on the top. Soups are so simple and so satisfying. And my kids loved soup when they were little kids. So you should give that a try.
Well, I noticed in the notes that you had here about a noodle soup that there's this good seasonings dressing idea that I'd never seen before. I'm going to try that.
Oh, my gosh. Do you know what? I found this recipe on Facebook for what it was called crack noodle soup. And in that soup, there was bacon, noodles, cream of chicken soup, chicken stock, milk, cheddar cheese,
wow.
And this good seasonings dressing. And I use it all the time now when I do noodle soup. When you saute your carrots and onions, that's when you add it. You add a packet of that, although I buy it by the carton now.
What is good seasonings dressing?
You know, like the buttermilk ranch dressing that you used to get. Hey,
oh,
people
okay.
eat
it's
that
just
stuff.
A spice mix.
Yes, people.
Oh,
well,
okay.
It used to be you couldn't buy it in a bottle. And I remember when my mom would send me to the store for a packet of that and a thing of buttermilk, that meant we were going to have that fabulous special occasion buttermilk ranch dressing. And now it's like everywhere, like ketchup. So, but yes, that adds a creaminess and a really cool flavor to a noodle soup. And of course, remember we talked about making homemade noodles, so I hope you tried that, Doug.
I'm going to. I got the new device just last week.
Ooh.
We'll see how it works.
Oh, yay. That's awesome.
I
should send you some buckwheat.
I think our next Main Street Eats is going to have to be a Zoom call with Sue giving noodle lessons, because I also have a pasta roller, so we can
cool.
have like a pasta off.
That would be so much fun. Yeah, we should do that couple of Zoom online cooking classes.
Ooh,
woohoo!
We check in with Root Cellar Sue every week on Main Street Eats. Always a pleasure, Sue.
Oh, thank you, guys. I love it.
Dakota Date Book is next.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by AARP North Dakota. providing caregiving resources, healthy living information, tips for families to avoid scams, and connecting with communities at fun events. They're creating real possibilities here in North Dakota. AARP.org/ND.
This is Dakota Datebook for November 12th. As what would become North and South Dakota moved towards statehood, regional differences became more apparent. The South had a population of over 98,000 in 1880, when the northern population was only 37,000. The two regions also had different commercial transportation routes. The North was tied to Minneapolis-St. Paul, the South to Omaha and Chicago. There was also something of a personality difference. The South tended to view itself as more civilized and cosmopolitan, while the North was seen as populated by cowboys and fur traders. When Nehemiah Ordway orchestrated moving the capital from Yankton in the South to Bismarck in the North, many Southerners felt angry and frustrated. The incident became known as the Capital Grab. On this date in 1887, the Press and Daily Dakotan of Yankton reported that voters decided in favor of dividing into North and South Dakota with immediate statehood for the South. Not everyone was so enthusiastic about a split. The territorial governor was in Washington to curry favor with President Cleveland. Governor Church wanted to block the division. The newspaper noted that there is nothing homogeneous between the northern and southern sections. Dakota Territory Supreme Court Judge J.A. Barnes said, "The people of northern Dakota want the division of the territory because they are so far remote from southern Dakota that they do not feel any identity of interest." The voters had spoken, but Church was determined to maintain one Dakota. His cause was helped by the federal response. Congress suggested either doing it as one state or waiting until both sections met the population requirement. Another source of contention was naming the new states. The southern portion wanted to be Dakota. Southerners said the North could become either the state of Pembina or the state of Lincoln, but the name Dakota had already become something of a trademark for agricultural products. Neither side wanted to give it up. President Harrison signed the paperwork for North and South Dakota statehood on November 2, 1889. Aware of the rivalry between the new states, Harrison shuffled the papers and signed them blindly. No one would ever know which gained statehood first. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Carol Butcher. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Thank you for joining us today for our broadcast in online Main Street across North Dakota. You can find any Main Street program at prairiepublic.org. Friday on our show, Terramera, a Canadian agritech company, says its global center for regenerative agriculture can transform how food is grown by fusing science, nature, and artificial intelligence. We'll talk about it with the CEO, Karn Manis. Then we'll recap the week's big stories with News Director Dave Thompson, and Matt Olean will review the new mockumentary starring Sacha Baron Cohen as Borat. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Friday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.